and largely ideologically, politically, and economically aligned with Western Europe. About the eastern third, including the southern region of the Crimea around the Black Sea, is majority Russian-speaking and aligned much more closely with Russia than with the West. So since all those events happened a couple of weeks ago, in the midst of this chaos, the Russian army moved into the Crimea and occupied it.
Without insignia.
Without insignia, yeah. It was all very Dune, if you've ever read those novels. Yeah, but anyway. Right. So the government in Crimea, which is already a semi-autonomous part of the Ukraine, voted to secede from the rest of Ukraine and align itself with Russia.
Well, the American press and I guess the State Department seemed to be implying that the election might have been fraudulent, but I don't see how fraudulent it could have been. Because it seems like everybody that we see on television, that we hear of, that we know of, and including the election results, say that about 97% of the people there wanted to realign with Russia and not with Ukraine.
Right, and I think in and of itself that's fine. And if a people want to determine their future in such a manner, I'm frankly all for it. The problem that I have, and this doesn't necessarily invalidate what happened there, the problem that I have is that this all happened under the shadow of Russian army guns.
Which are yet poised at the border of Ukraine on the Eastern Front.
Indeed. The Ukrainians, in the meantime, have voted themselves a pretty large emergency increase in their military budget, have called up their reserves, and are currently mobilizing and training an additional group of reservists.
Right, but I would assume that if it came to some kind of shooting thing, the Russian army would... by the millions overwhelm any kind of...
Oh, indeed. There's no question. I mean, there's no question. So the situation as it stands now is what does the rest of the world do? Particularly, what does the European Union do? I think that in general, it's not a good idea to condone what amounts to opportunism from Vladimir Putin. There was a situation of political chaos in the Ukraine. There is a section of the country that had, for a long time, wanted to align itself with Russia. So he took advantage. He sent in some troops, and then the vote was called. And then he passed a declaration upholding that vote and annexing the Ukraine into Russia.
Yeah, but
Crimea into
Russia.
And
to put this in historical perspective, under the old Soviet system, the dictatorship, the whims of the state system, created... the idea, in fact, the reality that Crimea would, instead of being part of the Russian Republic in the Soviet Socialist Republics, it would be part of Ukraine. And this was a reflection of Khrushchev's partiality to the Ukraine, his homeland.
Indeed. So in preserving those borders, those artificially drawn borders, we had this situation that we found ourselves in with a group of what are essentially Russians living in Ukraine.
Yes.
But at the same time, I can't say I support moving in a bunch of tanks, then calling a vote, then saying everything's square.
Well, that may be your feeling or mine, but so what?
Yeah, I agreed. So what?
What are you going to do?
What am I going to do? What is the United States going to do? Nothing. What can we do? Nothing.
Well, we can punish a bunch of oligarchs by seizing their assets.
Yes, and we have put in place a bunch of economic sanctions, but they really don't have any teeth.
No.
And they don't touch Putin or his inner circle.
And ironically, in fact, Putin is waging a fight, I won't call it a war, a fight on many fronts. First of all, he and his coterie, which are kind of similar to our CIA, really, that crowd, that conspiratorially oriented crowd that is Putin's age level and his buddies, see the greatest tragedy to befall the old Soviet Union was its dissolution and the loss of the multiple republics, particularly on the Western for them, the Western front. So this is, and then this is really important. The Western powers took advantage of that situation and have placed missiles and other weaponry of NATO in the republics that could have, and I think should have been, neutral powers in that region.
Indeed.
Thereby heightening reasonably, I think, the paranoia, the fear of the Russian Federation, and creating a casus belli for the Russians to feel like they need to get that turf back.
Right.
So and also, this is what's lining up here.
And let's be fair, an opportunity for Vladimir Putin to act in an imperialist way.
Yeah,
to expand his Russia.
Except that that whole region, which I call the Bloodlands after the book, describing the horrors of World War, pre-World War II through World War II and into today in that region, that is all a horrible place in terms of survival. If you happen to be ill-lucked, if you were a follower of Islam, if you were Jewish, any of a number of ethnic communities, you suffered harshly under the Nazis and as they moved through and under the Soviets.
Under the Soviets, yeah.
So it's nasty.
Right. So meanwhile, of course, the American media disinformation machine is making a lot of hay here. And the question has been posed on a number of fronts. Is this a new Cold War?
Right.
And I say the answer resoundingly is no.
It doesn't have to be.
No.
But I think
it doesn't have to be. But it isn't and doesn't remotely resemble the actual Cold War.
But here is what I consider now a very weak president, our president, who is pressed on the right by an insane posse, an insane militaristic posse with John McCain in the lead of it, calling for, you know, something horrible to be done to punish the Russians. Now, in reality, short of a nuclear holocaust or something, I don't see what the hell the West can do about this. We can have sanctions. And by the way, the problem with sanctions is after you move past the coterie of Putinists, after you move past his coterie.
Putineers?
Yeah, Putineers. That's better. Putineers. You move into the community of the oligarchs. And the Soviet era people who transitioned from supposedly higher end socialists immediately to capitalists and stole everything and now have everything, very wealthy, oil industry, et cetera, et cetera. Those people are actually on the other side are also Putin's enemies who he has routinely punished. And anything you do to punish them, to punish Russia, only strengthens Putin's hand.
Indeed. And also figuring into all of this is the fact that Western Europe depends for a large proportion of its natural gas supply on Russia. So it's there's definitely a vested interest in Western Europe to not punish Russia too severely,
right,
lest they turn off the gas spigots.
Right. And meanwhile, two very important things are held in abeyance while this is all happening. Perhaps in terms of humanitarian concern, the most important is an agreement on Syria. We've still not gotten all of those chemical weapons out of Syria. Syria is being blasted. Its people are being left homeless. It is a horrible situation, a civil war that goes on and on and on. Cities destroyed, an evil dictator in power, and triumphant right now, pretty much. That all is happening, and the Soviets, or pardon me, I'm still in another era. The Russians are, in fact, key to helping solve that problem. And then there's what looked like progress on the front of Iran and the end of the Iranian alleged attempt to build nuclear weapons. And that's held in abeyance as well.
Yes. Okay, so a couple minutes ago, I asked the question, is this a new Cold War? And the answer I said was no. Here's why.
Okay.
Well, what was the Cold War when you got right down to it? The Cold War was an ideological, political, and above all, economic standoff in a bipolar world. The two reigning superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, both possessed the capability, and it must be noted here that the United States and now Russia still possess the capability to wipe each other off the planet in a nuclear firestorm. Obviously, nobody wanted this to happen. So what happened instead? Well, the tensions between these two superpowers were squeezed to the periphery and popped up in the form of a number of proxy wars throughout the globe, including the situation in Afghanistan, including the Vietnam War, including the Korean War, and a number of other darker and very messy conflicts in developing nations around the world.
Yeah, Indonesia. I mean, we could go the list
and
is
on
long.
And on and on. Yes. So is what happened now anything like that? No, it is not. Russia is not a global superpower anymore. It is at best a regional power. It is clearly an expansionary one, if this annexation of the Crimea can be taken as any sort of example. But this isn't the Cold War and shouldn't be treated as the Cold War.
Well, but here's the problem. Putin wants, obviously, believes in the restoration. He believes that the dissolution of the Soviet Union was a great tragedy for the Russian people. And he wants a restoration at some level within the Federation of Russia of much of those borderlands. He would like to see a greater Russia as soon as possible and as effectively as
possible. Does he want to establish what essentially were buffer states between what used to be buffer states between Western Europe and the Soviet Union?
I believe
so. He wants that once again.
Well, I believe so, and I believe that in a way that is warranted. It's a warranted concern of the Russians, because instead of leaving those states as relatively unarmed nation states as buffer between the West and the East, we aggressively, that is Europe and the United States, armed and pushed into both the economic and military camp of the West.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a Russian oligarch, or you're a Russian nationalist, and you're looking at this, you would see, not being paranoid at all, just being objective, that there's an advancing Western force threatening your Western borders.
Right.
So any reaction is understandable, not necessarily correct or nice, but understandable. Mm-hmm. And in terms of real politics, this is the situation that we're in. Meanwhile, in the United States, the government of the United States is severely divided. There is a new, resurgent, crazy, know-nothing Republican Party, dominated by people who don't believe in science, truly, or at least say they don't, truly weird people who believe in military might. And I shudder to call it the left, but on the Democratic Party side, a sort of confused, not willing to become social democratic party. Not willing to support labor.
I think you're giving him too much credit.
Giving who too much credit?
The Democrats. But,
oh, okay. So, I'm not going to argue about
that. Yeah, of course, there's all sorts of opprobrium from the right being hurled at President Obama. They're saying he, and by extension, the United States, is impotent in this situation.
Well, it is.
Well, yeah. And that's no reflection on Obama as a leader. We couldn't do anything if we wanted to.
Right.
We have troops still stationed in Western Europe, but not enough of them to essentially push the Russians out of the Crimea, if that's what we wanted to do.
Well, that could be a Holocaust. It could be a nuclear disaster.
Yes, and further, why in the world would we want to do something like that? The European Union exists now. It didn't exist during the Cold War or before it. This is a European problem. Let the Europeans deal with it.
But that's not what's going to happen, I don't think.
Hmm.
I believe that you know, when we look at wars in the past, when we look at World War I, when we look at the Crimean War itself in the 1840s, we realize that these wars happen without the actual clear purposefulness that you would expect. And because of miscalculations. And I'm very concerned that there's a lot of miscalculation going on, both on the Russian side and on the American side right now. And I don't see any wiser heads prevailing in either society.
Yes, I have all the more reason to say not our problem.
Well, yeah, except that we have a weird ideological aggressiveness on the part of the right, which is at least 30% of the American people, who really, 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 really grew up with a Cold War mentality and really, really, really think that God is on their side.
Well, indeed. And in case of the elder statesman among that crowd, John McCain probably being the foremost.
Elder statesman.
Yeah, that's being charitable, sure.
It is being charitable,
yeah.
Yes.
I think probably missed the days of the big evil empire of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And probably have wanted to stick it to the Russians for pretty much their entire adult lives.
Well, they grew up with the ideology of the Cold War. So,
In preparing for this show,
yeah.
If anybody wants to check out our show page, www.kboo.fm/the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. It's a long address. But
it's a long address.
I'm counting on you to spell it correctly. there's a really cool image up there of a Cold War era propaganda poster. And it shows a white blonde-headed American woman splayed out on the ground underneath the boot, a big Russian boot. And the picture is titled, If the Russians Win. And when I was looking for images to post, there's some unbelievable Cold War propaganda imagery from both sides in that era. Unbelievable stuff. I encourage you to do a Google search of it. That'll give you some idea of the sort of insanity that held sway on both sides of that divide during the Cold War. So, and that's another reason why you really can't compare what's going on now to that era.
So I guess what we want to do, asking our brilliant statesmen listeners what their ideas about this are, how they perceive it, and really what they think, as Lenin once famously said, what is to be done?
503-231-8187 is the number to call. I'm sorry, who? BJ, good morning.
Morning. What is to be done?
What is to be done?
That's the sign of the time. But however, one of the problems is that the huge expenditure of the Central Intelligence and NOSUCH or NSA, I mean, they get $35 billion a quarter. I mean, they need to spend that somewhere. I was in the Army, and I kind of did a little history of Stalin, and of course, Putin is his name, not Putin.
Oh,
Putin.
Yes. Well.
You got to be careful with that because they don't like it. Anyway, I noticed that the 71st Rifle Corps were the first into the Reichstag when it was burning, being bombed by the Russian Air Force, such as it was, but they had 1 million men. I mean, we won the outer part of the war, the Battle of the Bulge. I mean, Eisenhower and Bradley Omar, wonderful five-star generals. There weren't many of those. There were five of them, actually, two admirals. And the Reichstag was burning, and, of course, Hitler and Eva Braun, and he took his defense minister, Bormann, down into the bunker out in front there in the square. You know where I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And what happened was...
Been there many times.
They had a helicopter, Helio, which I am a little bit familiar with, but they were... And the 71st Rifle Corps was going to get them, see? So they were right there, two steps behind, and Hitler got airlifted out of the bunker. Now, you can check this out, and the company knows about it, but... And Eva Braun, you know, they got married later, and they went to U-35. That's a U-boat, and they managed to get down into on the pocket battleship Graf Spree. But actually, they got airlifted over to Lisbon, Portugal, and then they went down.
Wait, hold it.
No, Hitler died in
you
that
got
bunker.
You got an alternative history here going.
No, that's not what happened.
Well,
we've been covered up with that. He never did die there. He died in Argentina. When he was 80.
But in any event, we're digressing here from the issue at hand, which
well,
is...
Well, that's one of the reasons. See, the Soviets or the Russians know that, and we don't. Our people think the war... Well, anyway, go ahead, ask questions.
Well, you leave us in a kind of odd limbo because...
I'm sorry, Joe. I'm
you
sorry,
really,
Joe.
You really do. You really have created something that... You've opened
well,
a door.
I was there, so I know a little about it.
All right, I'm not going to do. I don't want to spend the show disputing whether or not Hitler died
in
the bunker.
I'm not disputing anything about that. But what I am,
Yeah, you are.
Most people don't know that, but he got married and they lived until he was up in his 80s.
I thought you were going to say they lived happily ever after.
No, I don't know. They had 1,000 acres in Lake Grustig up out of Argentina, Buenos Aires.
Okay.
That the Bormann purchased with the gold of Jewish teeth, and they've extracted a lot out of mine. And I don't like to see, of course, that kind of thing going on. I want to prevail, don't you? You know. I'm sorry, I'm an old-timer, and I guess I'm at the verge of not wanting to see fascism rise up again. But they never did die. You see, little pieces of it are all around, and they're picking up those pieces of gold. And Bormann came over and reinforced it.
Okay, I'm gonna cut you off, because this whole alternative history that you presented here is not something... I at least am prepared to go into today. I really want to focus on the current events and the history leading up to these current events. I appreciate your ideas. I am not ready to explore them. I don't think Abe is either. And I really don't want to get our audience off on this discussion of what really happened to Hitler. Okay?
History is the way the Nazis and the Third Reich ended. And
yeah,
the,
yeah.
The connection with it with the Soviet Union.
Okay. All right. I'm going to let that go. Please, no calls about what really happened to Hitler. Please. Okay.
Hey. All right. Who's next? Ralph, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Yeah.
You know, I want to expand on this a little bit because...
On which?
No, not the... we'll just leave that one set for a while. There's a lot more going on behind the scenes than you guys have mentioned. And let me just bring a... couple of things to the fore. I mean, you're
sure.
Pretending like Obama is just some passive observer, and that's not true at all. These guys have been pumping billions of dollars into the Ukraine. I mean, this is not a popular revolt. This is a planned takeover. Zbigniew Brzezinski, I know.
Zbigniew, yeah.
I mean, that was his foreign policy advisor. He's a former Polish person. He's been wanting to take, you know, Russia down forever. The deal that they're trying to set up with the IMF, so-called aid, is another one of these loans that gets the country into debt, and then they basically own the country. And let me say something about the convenient timing of doing this during the Sochi Olympics. They had snipers on the roof, right? They were shooting people. Well, it turns out these snipers are part of this old system that was never taken down called Operation Gladio that was set up by the West. And they were shooting both people. They were shooting the police and the protesters. And this has been proven by looking at the corpses and identifying that the bullets were the same bullets. And so this is a Western destabilization operation to try to encroach into Russia. There, Russia and China are the only really powers that are left to stand in the way of the U.S. and not even the U.S. I mean, this is an international deal of taking over and dictating the terms, and they feel like this is the time to do it. And you know, it's one of those things where you don't want to praise Russia because obviously they have all sorts of issues, but you know, they're trying to defend themselves.
Well, that's certainly, they take the position you're taking. That is that this is a conspiracy, that there has been, ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union, an effort to both destabilize and limit the Russian Federation. And remember, Putin, I'm not going to change this way I say it because I'm just an American, that Putin is definitely a person who believes that the greatest tragedy to befall modern man is the collapse of the Soviet Union. And he has been very, very concerned, and his concern has appeared objectively warranted because of things like what you're suggesting. Certainly, the creation of an armed camp around the former Soviet client states bears out his concerns. As to the question of the Crimea, which is an important but a little bit separate thing, Crimea had been for a long time, since the 1700s, a part of Russia. In fact, there was a war between the British and the Muslim states and Russia called the Crimean War in the 1840s. And this Crimean, the value of the Crimea is enormous because it is the access route to the Mediterranean through the Black Sea and thence to the Atlantic by Russia. It is very, very important, and also is part of something called the Great Game, which, oddly enough, Rudyard Kipling in his novel Kim talks about, which is the effort by Russia. This was pre-communist Russia, effort by Russia to establish a set of warm sea ports in the Bay of Bengal. This is all real. This is all something that went on for a long, long time in the 1800s and into the 1900s.
Well, and you know, when you mentioned Brzezinski wrote the book The Grand Chessboard, which is based off of that.
Right.
And this is, like you said, this has been going on for a long time. I mean, the powers that be like to play these games, and, you know, unfortunately, things can get really deadly. Human history is nothing but, you know, one ruler going after another, and I think this is a case of when you say, well, we're going to put missiles in Poland so we can defend ourselves against non-existent missiles coming out of Iran. I mean, you know, come on, Russia obviously knows those are intended as a first strike capability.
Mm-hmm.
The Victoria Nuland, who works for the State Department, basically picks who's going to be the leader. And, oh, by the way, there's the guy that's the leader who is a fascist. Now you have a crowd of people I don't think any of the Ukrainians are too happy about the people that have taken over there.
Well, one way to look at this is to try to fantasize that, say, Mexico or Canada were suddenly in the hands of people like the people you're describing. How would the United States react? And I just throw that out, and I don't want to really explore that intensely, but, you know, think about that. Think about it in terms of real politics. And I agree with your pointing out the role of our State Department in all of this.
Well, let me say one more thing. This is really the bottom line. The only reason that the U.S. is able to toss its weight around is, A, they have a huge military, mm-hmm. and, B, the United States dollar is the reserve currency. In other words, if you want to buy oil or you want to have your money currency backed up, you have to have dollars. Well, Russia and China and Iran have had enough of this, and they're starting to trade in their own currency and with gold. And if that happens, if the U.S. reserve does not become the reserve currency, then it's game over for our economy. And that's what the battle is. It's not about Ukraine. It's not about anything. It's about keeping the dollar, the reserve currency, and Russia and China are making steps to get rid of that, and that is why this is going to be a war, and that's why Abe's wrong. This is war.
You think it's going to be like a hot war, shooting people?
Bombing cities, all that stuff? Okay, if you are using the reserve currency to bully yourself and suddenly you're like the British Empire and oops, no more power, you're going to go to war.
Now, I didn't say there wouldn't be a war. What I said was this was not the Cold War come again.
No, it's different, but it's just as serious because we are, you know, I don't know if you've looked at the debt lately of this country, but it's completely unpayable. And, who's holding the bag on a lot of that, you know?
Well, that's
China,
you know,
whatnot.
I think you're making some very interesting points. Part of the problem here is that I'm not seeing any good guys.
Of course not.
There is none of the mythology that at least existed in fighting the just fight of World War II. The United States is an imperial power and is aggressing. The former Soviet Union, Russia, is in fact a totalitarian state with no real freedoms, no real democracy, and is engaged in, at this point, an effort to regain an empire that it lost quite a few years ago.
Well, I mean, government is basically organized crime that has a court system that makes it look legitimate. I mean, that's the only difference between them and organized crime is they have a judicial system that can back them up. But, that's the way I look at it. So, of course, it's one gang going after another, and gangs like to shoot up, you know, people, and people are going to get hurt in this.
Well, in general, in criminology theory, since you brought this up, The difference between organized crime and legitimate states is that legitimate states have law to enforce. Organized crime has to resort to the use of force because it doesn't have an adjudication system. So I kind of like your analogy, but it's not quite complete. Anyway, listen, I want to give others an opportunity.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Very provocative.
Yeah, no, I think it was interesting.
Now
I'm depressed. I don't want to. Let's change this. So let's talk about puppies.
No.
Puppies.
This... this notion of
no puppies.
A transition away from the American dollar as essentially a way to store value, which is when you value the world's oil reserves in terms of American dollars, that's what you've got.
Yeah,
that's a very interesting and provocative suggestion in this context. There are many who think, myself among them, that Saddam Hussein's plan to value his country's oil reserves in euros rather than in dollars before the Iraq war helped precipitate the Bush administration's decision to invade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a very good question here. Whether or not that will come to pass in the context of this current tension over Ukraine and the Crimea, I guess that remains to be seen.
Yeah, and I have to say, the bottom line here, we talk a little bit about Obama, but... You know, he can pretend that they're going to be harsh and do something to the Russians. The fact of the matter is we don't have a lot of toys to play with.
No,
that,
we can't. We can't, nor should we.
Right. And I think
bring that, force to bear on the Russians.
And I think Europe has is held hostage largely by the fact that most of its natural gas supply comes from Russia, goes through the Ukraine.
Yes.
I mean, this is and it's been played with before. This is a very real thing. And Obama is under enormous, bizarre pressure from a crazy right wing in this country that believes that the entire universe is only 6 days old. So what are you going to do? You know, crazy people are in charge a lot.
What are we going to do? We're going to go to our callers. That's what we're going to do. David, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a great topic. I think it's more Cold War fear-mongering put on by the corporate oil grab plutocrats and the military, U.S. military industrial complex. I mean, we talk about Russia being not free. Who says that? It's the corporate media. They fear it.
Well,
let me say one thing. In the U.S., the Russians see that the U.S. mayor in New York will not let gays or lesbians walk in a parade. So where do they say that? Where do we say that? And, you know, if Putin said it was terrorism, then it would be fine, wouldn't it? Because we invade. It's funny that the U.S. feigned outrage at this. I mean, we talk about sovereignty. The U.S., how many countries do we ignore sovereignty? Pakistan.
Well, now you're right, of course.
Yes, of course.
Yemen, Somalia.
Yeah.
And then we had Navy SEALs on a Libyan-bound tanker yesterday. We don't even know who's in charge of Libya. We say it's freedom fighters, but we don't know. And, you know, we should thank Putin because he kept us out of Syria. If he didn't take a stand, we would be in Syria right now. We'd be in a third war.
I'm not disputing what you say, but let's not have any illusions about Russia, okay?
Well, I don't have any illusions about the U.S. either. They
no,
say we're
no,
free.
Not at all.
Free. You can't become a president unless you pay the media. You have to pay millions to the media so they put you on TV. You know that.
Well, you know, you're bringing a lot of different things together. I think that the illusion of the United States as the good, the virtuous, and the absolutely free and democratic state is an illusion. I also think it's a real mistake to characterize Russia as anything other than a totalitarian state with oligarchs running its economic system in cooperation largely with people like Putin. And he comes out of the tradition of the KGB. So it's not, I mean, it's really not, there's not any, how should I put this? There's no dog that I like in the fight.
Right, and exactly. And, you know, we can say the same thing about our leaders. They're in, their pockets are lined with corporate money.
Well, sure. And we can also point out that we have the largest number of prisoners. Amy Goodman, just before our show, was talking about this. Largest
right.
number of prisoners in any country and huge numbers of them in the inhumanity of solitary confinement. So my point is, I want to deal with the real politic, that is to say, what is to be done practically, rather than talk about good guys and bad guys, because I really don't think there's any good guys or bad guys here.
Well, I don't think
or
anything.
Everybody's bad.
They're just stirring up the soup for us to go to war again. We got this military industrial complex. They want to go to another war.
Well, I'm not sure they do.
We need to get rid of our cruise missiles so we can, because it's getting stale on the shelves.
I think.
And
Yeah, I think what we like to do when we go to war is to use our equipment in a proxy war against or in a client state. I don't think the U.S. has ever really wanted, at least not the majority of the military thinkers and the government people and so on, and capital itself, ever really wanted to have an all-out nuclear war with a powerful nuclear nation like either China or Russia.
Well, you know, look what happened in Vietnam. The Gulf of Tonkin, that was a farce. We created a pretext to invade.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Let's talk about Iraq. The UN was against, no one in the world was forced going into war. We ignored the international community, and we preemptively strapped. Okay?
Yeah, nobody's disputing this.
Now the outrage at Russia, you know, and if they call it terrorism, then I guess it's okay, right? Because we invade under the pretext of terrorism everywhere. And if Mexico went Islamic, do you think we'd sit on our thumbs? We would invade in the first 30 seconds.
Yes, indeed. Well, okay, that's sort of a reductio ad absurdum sort of argument. Mexico is not going to overnight become a Muslim country. And secondly, I'm not disputing anything you say about the motives of the United States in the recent past and even in the more distant past, nor do I dispute your claims about the need of our military-industrial complex to find something to blow up to justify its existence. But the question I want to pose to you again and to the rest of our listeners is, what do we do? I submit the answer is, we don't do anything.
Exactly.
We let the Europeans deal with it.
Exactly. Now, maybe 200 years from now, Crimea is going to call this the Revolutionary War. The Russians in Crimea say this is what finally we became independent, and we had to help with our neighbors, Russia. I mean, we can't just say that this is, I mean, of course, war is a bad thing.
Well, no, the Crimea is not looking to become independent. The Crimea is looking to become part of Russia.
Right, but they want independence from Ukraine.
Okay,
right. And so, of course, a thing that we haven't talked about is that Ukraine, after it got its separation from the Soviet Union, became more and more a kleptocracy. And in fact, the people were suffering. The money was bunched more and more in the hands of a few people at the top. And it got really, really bad. And the whole reason why this situation became unstable was because of the enormous inequities developing in Ukraine. And not to mention nationalist interests. And we haven't even talked about, I mean, we really haven't even begun to talk about the Tartars, the ethnic peoples who are, in fact, followers of Islam, who are a significant population in that region and didn't vote at all.
And very saucy, the Tartars.
Well, and, you know,
that was a bad joke.
Yes.
Don't let him make bad jokes. Sorry.
I mean, every parallel we can draw about this so-called Soviet Empire, we can look at the elections and with Bush down in Florida. I mean, that wasn't free and fair vote.
Yeah, you know, one of the problems with this whole conversation is that in reality, the mythologies that are engaged in by both sides, particularly in our case by the United States, fall apart in a careful examination, which is something you're pointing out. But again, what I think Abe and I are looking for is some brilliant touch of solution out of all of you out there in the audience. And I'm going to suspect, not because you're inadequate, not because you don't know things, all of you, but because it's really difficult to find it. What in God's name, would be the solution to this incredible tangle, which can lead through blunder and stupidity and overestimation or underestimation of potential violence directly into another, I don't think Cold War is the right term, but another situation where the whole region is engaged in a buildup of arms even again.
Listen, I think we stay out of it.
I agree. I think we're going to leave it there. I really appreciate your call, but we want to give some others a chance here before the end.
And thanks a lot, you guys.
You bet.
Yeah.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is KBOO, 90.7 FM. I'm Abe, and that's Joe, and this is the Abe and Joe Show.
Yeah, and I'm depressed. Again, still.
Yes. All right, so the question we've been posing is, what do we do now?
Lenin, what is to be done?
What is to be done? Yeah. Or to put it another way, what ought the United States not to do in this situation is a very pertinent question.
Well, I'm very concerned about Obama because I feel like he doesn't have the spine that I had hoped and believed he had in 08.
Oh, God, not even close. The man's an enormous disappointment. But again, we digress.
Yeah, and what has happened in the meantime is Roger Ailes and others have recreated the Republican Party into a party of crazies.
Well, I think that crazy was always there. They're just now in charge.
Right.
There's the adults used to be, run the show in the Republican
Party.
Well,
there used to be a way to come together to do mutually, casually. In a general way, things that benefited the society, the military industrial complex, the congressional complex, and so on. That has fallen apart to a great extent.
Yes, there used to be a semblance of reason among the Republicans, but that's all gone now.
I don't see that. Yeah.
No. Who's next, Steve? Theodore, good morning.
Hey, guys. You've been talking around this thing for 43 minutes, and you're not getting down to what you do. This is a real plan right here.
Let's hear it.
And that is, you get something called you shoot Saabs at their airplanes.
Wait a minute. Shoot what? What at their? What do you? Wait a minute. You shoot what at their airplanes?
Saabs. S-A-A-B. It's no.
The cars?
No, Saab is an aircraft company, and they make a $100,000 missile that you can shoot airplanes down with. We had Stingers 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Now there's stuff that's more advanced.
Okay, so you want to shoot whose planes down?
You give them to the Ukrainian military, and that way they can't get any of their planes 10 to 15,000 feet from the surface. They've got to fly over the country. That means you can't land paratroops into eastern Ukraine.
Well, so, what does that do? I mean, what's the advantage of that?
What it does is it checkmates them, just like we checkmated them in Afghanistan. If they can't, the bottom line to controlling any theater of operation is your aircraft. If you can get anti-tank and anti-aircraft handheld stuff,
mm-hmm.
you are going to checkmate these guys. And the other thing that they absolutely have to do, they have to expand the confiscation of these oligarch monies that are in Switzerland and London and New York and the Caymans, et cetera, et cetera.
You do understand that the oligarchs are also the enemies of Putin to a great extent, and that it doesn't hurt his government to have their money seized.
Well, I think that's a decent argument. I don't know if it's altogether true. But the other thing that you've got to do, because Russia, McCain is right, Russia is, it's a gas station masquerading as a country. And they've got, Europe, yes, they get about 32% of their nat gas through Ukraine.
Yeah.
And what the Europeans ought to do is they ought to put a 40% tariff on those gas pipeline. And that's how you finance a buildup in the Ukrainian military. You make the Russians pay for it; otherwise, they can't.
So you actually want to a hot war, Ukraine?
No, I don't want a hot war.
Well, what do you think would happen?
The deal is, these states, Ukraine and Poland. Now Poland's in the EU, but the Europeans have no interest in not having buffer states. And, you know, what you guys don't understand, you don't even know what, I don't think you know what the Cold War was about. The Cold War was essentially about keeping relatively free peoples in Western Europe free. And the whole oil game and everything, it's about keeping the lights on in Western Europe. And so you can finance this whole thing, and you can checkmate the Russians with they've got a declining economy. And that's how you do it.
So your answer to
finances itself.
So your answer to the question, what is to be done, is to fight a proxy war in the Ukraine. But you just said earlier that you give these things. You said we give these weapons, these missiles, to the Ukrainian military, and that the Europeans should apply a tariff to Russian natural gas to fund the Ukrainian military so that they can check Russian aggression in the Crimea and the rest of Ukraine Eastern Europe.
Here's another part of your logic. Europe has to have natural gas or some sort of fuel. The fuel that's available that would benefit enormously the American oil industry and the international oil industry is the fracked oil, the fracked gasoline. So the fracked gas. So what we're going to find is a destruction of the American water table entirely so that we can produce natural gas and ship it all over the world to produce petrodollars to enrich the petroleum industry in the United States. I don't see that as a solution to anything.
Am I still on?
Yes. Yeah, you are.
Okay. So, no, I don't support fractured oil. I don't support it. I'm just saying that you don't collaborate with the Russians. You don't, you know, going pinko doesn't help anybody in the end. What the deal is you're saying that...
you are aware that the Soviet Union is not a communist state anymore, right? The Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, right?
If you do that, then he's going to be in Berlin and in Paris in 5 years.
Wait a minute. Hold it. I really have to interrupt you there. I do not think that the ambitions of the Russian state is to conquer Europe at this point. I think their ambitions, at most, is to regain the lost states of the Soviet Union.
Well, thank you for the call.
But thanks for the call.
Hard to know where to begin there.
I don't know. I just am extremely... querulous and depressed, because it seems to me that it's almost pointless to have this conversation, because in reality, in real politics terms, any solution anyone can come up with, including far out ideas like we just heard, and I will call them far out, are not going to solve anything. The only possibility is a negotiated solution, which at this point seems very far from doable.
You have the entirety of Western Europe that is organized, albeit loosely, and mm-hmm. aligned, albeit loosely, politically and economically, and to a certain extent militarily.
Yeah.
Why can they not address this problem in their region with an aggressor in their region? Why does this need to be? Why does a solution need to be brokered by the United States, or why does there need to be a military intervention on the behalf of the United States?
Well, I think part of the answer to that is that we our vocabulary response as a nation, as an empire, is very limited, and historically, ever since the Civil War, our solution to these kinds of problems has been to engage in armed conflict. So that's the language we use, and it's the language that Europe uses, and it's the language that Asia uses,
and the entire world uses.
It's always used. Yeah, it's the talk. We are very limited vocabulary.
There will always be wars and rumors of wars.
Well, I am beginning to think that might be true. I don't know. I mean, my point of view is, okay, Ukraine gets broken up, probably.
That's what I see happening.
An unstable and bloody region during World War II and previously. It is still a dysfunctional nation state, although the breadbasket, actually, of the old Soviet Empire. In the course of all of this, what ends up happening is the Crimea goes clearly to the Russians. The only question in my mind now is there going to be enough disorder in Ukraine, in eastern Ukraine, that will justify and rationalize the entry of Soviet troops and a chopping off of the
whole
east?
There aren't any more Soviet troops.
I shouldn't have said that. Russian troops.
See how easy it is to slip
I grew up in the Cold War. What can I say?
All right. Well, here's what I see happening. I think in all likelihood, when this is over, the Crimea will be part of Russia.
Yeah.
And there really won't be anything that the United States or Ukraine or Western Europe can do about it.
Yes.
And that will probably be the equilibrium at which we arrive at eventually. The problem is that I think Vladimir Putin, having seen how well this worked, basically sending in troops then calling a vote, then calling this place part of Russia, he may decide that that might work elsewhere. You know, and that could potentially be a problem for his neighbors. But again, that's a problem for his neighbors, not for the United States.
Well, you remember, you're making the kind of argument that people used to make in the 1930s.
Am I saying, should we be an isolationist here? Yes. Yeah. Damn right, we should be isolationists here. There's no upside for the United States getting involved in this problem.
Well, except for the military-industrial complex, which makes them more powerful and curbs even further democracy in the West, particularly in the United States.
If that is the aim of the ruling class here, then yes, I suppose that's an upside. But for the rest of us, the working people of the United States, we don't win in this situation if we get involved.
No, I agree. I think that this is a problem that we do not need to solve. And I think that restraint is what's needed. On the other hand, I am very aware that the administration in Washington, the Democratic administration, is under enormous pressure by hawks who have dominated American foreign policy in past years a lot, and who are able to disconnect the liberal, so-called liberal, as a barely liberal, Democratic Party from power by saying that the Democrats are weak on this issue.
Yeah.
So you fall into the hands of the right-wing nudies.
Yeah, it's...
Nutties.
It's not a good situation.
People.
We ought to steer clear of this situation.
So it's a very bad situation. And I think, actually, the fact of the matter is that Putin is ill-advised, because we don't know, but we suspect there's no limit to what he will do once he's successful in one area. He may try another. And he's definitely advised by people around his age who came out of the equivalent of the CIA and are pretty, pretty crazy.
You know what this Crimean situation reminds me of historically more than anything else?
What?
Is the Anschluss, the annexation of Austria by Nazi Germany. It happened similarly.
Well, that's going to be the argument that will be made to bring the United States into a war with Russia.
But Russia is not Nazi Germany. It's not the same sort of thing. The tactics are similar. But the context is completely different, just as the context is completely different from the Cold War.
Let's get some more of our brilliant
callers. Yes, let's do that. Cheryl, good morning. Oh, too bad. I was hoping Cheryl might rescue us from ourselves. Cherelle.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. America provoked this. We provoked it. And so now we've got this situation.
How did we provoke it?
Well, you provoke it when you have an ambassador that's handing out cookies to demonstrators during a period of instability in a country, while supposedly Russia was supposed to be distracted by its Olympics to not pay attention to some of the stuff that we were initiating in their streets. I mean, there's evidence that the person that's in power in the Ukraine was kind of handpicked by that lady ambassador.
That's true.
Ms. Nuland.
So there's all sorts of provocatory behavior on the part of our country, and it looks like at this point in time that Putin has made good use of it, and it's served his purposes, and what he's seeking for his country at this time is pretty strategic, because it's connected to the Black Sea and all that kind of blah, blah, blah. But what we're left with is Russia has already removed something like $140 billion from the Federal Reserve, and that there's another quantity of money that's going out the door, which I haven't read myself, but somebody told me, according to Wall Street, is Chinese money and the Iranian money. So what we're going to be left with is a very likely economic implosion in this country, which will cause a lot of problems. And all we can do at this point is we have to be share and care people. And I'm fortunate that I'm amongst a giant network of people, many of whom are family, relatives, and neighbors, and more concerned people.
You know, we have to end you because we've run out of time.
Too bad.
I think your points were well taken.
We could talk about this for another three hours.
We could easily talk about this another 3 or 4 hours. We may revisit this topic again. I want to thank you all. I want to urge you to stay tuned to KBOO. Remember, we are the only radio station that deals with issues directly and without the intervening main assumptions of nationalism.
And I got to thank our callers. You guys are brilliant today.
All right.
Very well done. We'll be back at you next week.
From the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all. It's coming from the silence on the dock of the bay, from the brave, the bold, the battered heart of Chevrolet. Democracy is coming to the
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and electronic artists from around the globe. Win tickets and stay up on events each and every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on The Melting Pot, right here at 90.7 FM KBOO.
This KBOO program... This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com. And by X-ray.fm. And by X-Ray.fm. The people at X-Ray.fm would like to thank KBOO for 45 years of work in the service of better community radio for Portland and the world. X-Ray.fm is proud to support the pioneering work of KBOO and wouldn't be here without it. And by Merrillhurst University's 5 part-time MBA programs, each designed to provide an educational experience and a transformational journey for those who want to move business forward to change the world around them. Enrolling now for spring term, details at merrillhurst.edu. Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's a minute after 9. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First, it's Alternative Radio with host David Barsamian. Today, we'll hear a lecture by award-winning journalist Max Blumenthal entitled Goliath Israel. And at 10, it's Air Cascadia with cutting-edge news and views with Chris Andre. At 10:15, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news journalism, with host Dennis Bernstein. Today, the corporate press becomes the U.S. State Department's flak in the Ukraine. Also, indigenous communities from all over California protest Jerry Brown's plan for expanded fracking. And we'll have a brief report on a new rolling fast by mothers standing against the deportation of thousands of undocumented workers and their families. At 11, we'll hear Stage and Studio with guest host S.W. Conser. Today's guest is Oscar winning filmmaker and the creator of Claymation, Will Vinton, and musician David Pomeranz, who are about to launch The Kiss at the Lakewood Theater. And at 11:30, we'll hear Art Focus with host Joseph Gallivan. Today's guest is artist Heather Watkins. Her new show is called Recurrent Work, now showing at the Art Gym at Merrillhurst University. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you aren't a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now here's Alternative Radio.
Netanyahu has to be taken seriously from a psychological perspective because he has also passed through this process of indoctrination. And he has to be contended with on that basis, that he is not addressing the situation in a rational way with regard to the Palestinians or with regard to the Iranians, and nor are his deputies, and neither are an increasing number of Jewish Israelis who are subjected to this siege mentality, which is amplified and accelerated by an ongoing and endless occupation for which Netanyahu has no solution. It's a very dangerous situation.
That's Max Blumenthal, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Max Blumenthal, Israel, Siege Mentality. Everyone knows the biblical story of how little David slew mighty Goliath with his slingshot. and the State of Israel, formed in 1948 in the aftermath of the Holocaust, for many years saw itself as a modern-day David, holding off powerful enemies. Over the years, perceptions and realities have changed. Israel is technologically advanced, with a high standard of living, exceeding European countries in some instances. It has a world-class military with nuclear weapons and the rockets to deliver them. It has crucial political, financial, and military support from the United States. Its policies vis-à-vis the Palestinians continue to be opposed. International calls for boycott, divestment, and sanctions are gaining traction. Some musicians refuse to perform in Israel. The 5,000-member American Studies Association voted to boycott Israeli academic institutions. A Dutch pension giant disinvested from five Israeli banks. Ahava and SodaStream products, both made on the occupied West Bank, are the targets of boycotts. In response, a siege mentality has taken hold in the ruling Netanyahu government, which builds more high-tech border fences and more settlements. From Kissinger to Baker to Kerry, U.S. secretaries of state engage in endless rounds of shuttle diplomacy. They issue rosy statements about progress and breakthroughs, but little changes. Israel has created concrete facts on the ground. Settlement building on Palestinian land, illegal under international law, has expanded over decades. Some 500,000 Israelis live in settlements from Ariel to Male Adumim. Jeffrey Goldberg, writing in Bloomberg.com, calls them self-destructive. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman says, settlement building constitutes tacit annexation of the West Bank and is not winning Israel friends in Europe or America. The West Bank, supposedly the home of a future Palestinian state, has been sliced and diced into pieces. Not only are there massive settlements, which use huge amounts of scarce water, but Israeli-only road networks and so-called security barriers and walls are effectively turning Palestinian areas into isolated enclaves. Thus, the fabric of a just and lasting peace is tattered and becomes more remote. Our guest today is Max Blumenthal. He's an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and The Nation. He's the author of Republican Gomorrah and Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado. And now, Max Blumenthal.
John Kerry was just in Israel, and this was part of Obama's overall push for a rapprochement for negotiations with Iran. When Obama had to send Wendy Sherman, who's his chief negotiator with Iran, to Israel to kind of vet what the U.S. wanted to do with Iran first, with this small country that's smaller than New Jersey. And Wendy Sherman was sent packing by Netanyahu, who angrily denounced her and had his proxies in Congress, like Mark Kirk, the largest recipient of AIPAC money in Congress, declare that Obama is anti-Israel, a guy who's funding the occupation to the hilt. John Kerry called for these kind of milquetoast,